This is The Takeaway. I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Tanzina Vega. American leaders have long held up the national parks as physical representations of our country's highest aspirations and ideals. Teddy Roosevelt called the parks one of the best bits of national achievement which our people have to their credit. And writer and historian Wallace Stegner famously called them the best idea we ever had, absolutely American, absolutely democratic. They reflect us at our best rather than our worst. But these places have not necessarily lived up to these lofty descriptions. Today, we continue our week-long conversation about national parks with a look at how Americans of color were excluded from them, starting decades before Woodrow Wilson established the National Park Service in August 1916.
The same areas of segregation that existed during the Woodrow Wilson administration carried through our national parks and other wild and scenic places all the way up through the 1940s and into the 1950s. And many of these public spaces weren't fully desegregated until the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
That's James Edward Mills, a freelance journalist and the author of The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. Segregation and other forms of systemic racism have had a lasting effect on who visits these parks today. According to a 2018 study, less than 2% of national park visitors were Black. But James, along with environmental educator Nicole Jackson, a Next Generation Advisory Council member at the National Parks Conservation Association, told Tanzina Vega that this disparity is beginning to change.
Many of these public spaces weren't fully desegregated until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So much of what we imagine as our national parks being an open and egalitarian space for public access really wasn't for everyone until very late in the 20th century. So what we're seeing right now is a relatively new phenomenon of seeing more people of color being welcome and engaged as part of, you know, the national park experience.
What effect did that type of segregation have on the relationship that people of color in the United States have with the national parks? Because we know attendance is quite low.
Well, I think a big part of it has to do with segregation in all aspects of American life. I mean, we have divisions in terms of how people spend much of their time, whether we're talking about education or science or access to public health care or a variety of other things. The national parks and other outdoor recreation opportunities were part of that. And so one of the things that is also added to the mix is the very real possibility of racially motivated violence that could occur in wooded areas, which our long storied history of lynching basically takes place in wooded areas. With that, you have the de facto segregation of housing discrimination of the 1930s that again carried on through the 1960s that prevented people of color from living, working, playing, going to places outside of areas that were primarily urban. And that ultimately gets reinforced and codified into African-American culture, so much so that you have entire generations of people who tell themselves and tell each other that camping isn't for us. You know, spending time in the outdoors isn't for us. And unfortunately, that becomes part of, you know, the African-American identity, you know, so much so that we say things like Black people don't camp. And when we take a look at how we go about correcting that, really the only way we can do that is to hopefully do a better job of telling history of Black people in the outdoors, which goes all the way back to the beginning of the national park system, but unfortunately was made unaware to a lot of people because we don't have very much in the way of stories that are being told. But fortunately, the Park Service is doing a much better job of doing that today than they have in years past.
It's interesting that you should say that because there is this duality. I think for myself, being a Puerto Rican woman who grew up in low-income housing and, you know, in quote-unquote urban areas in New York City, just access to urban parks wasn't a thing. We just didn't do that. But at the same time, we would spend a lot of time in nature in Puerto Rico when we visited there. So there was a sort of disconnect. Nicole, I'm curious, did you have a similar experience with nature growing up where you just were not as, it just wasn't as accessible? Did you feel subject to the stereotype that made you feel like you didn't belong in the outdoors or that just wasn't something that you were going to do?
Yeah, so I am originally from Cleveland, Ohio. I grew up in a big family, 10 siblings. I have 7 sisters and 3 brothers, and grew up in inner city Cleveland. And I actually do have a lot of memories being in inner city Cleveland, visiting a lot of our neighborhood pocket parks, but not anything nature related. It was a lot of gatherings, you know, to have barbecues and picnics with family members for reunions or just to catch up, and then, you know, basketball or recess when we were in school. So that was pretty much the gist of my exposure to the outdoors growing up.
And did you also, I'm wondering if there was also, there's sort of a stereotype that camping and outdoor activities is a masculine thing versus a woman thing?
Yes, definitely. And I think that comes a lot with just knowledge of how to do things when you're going out, whether you're by yourself or with family or with friends, that there's this, you know, amount of knowledge that you need in order to be outdoors camping or doing any type of recreation successfully from a gender's perspective.
James, some of the best known, I should say, conservationists in this country are all white guys, despite people of color having played an important role in the creation of national parks. Give me some examples of what you were talking about in terms of the roles that people of color have played.
Well, frankly, we really need to go back no further than the beginning of the national park system and the creation of national parks like Yosemite. In 1903 to 1906, over 400 members of the U.S. Cavalry, a unit known as the Buffalo Soldiers, an all-African-American contingent of U.S. Army regulars, were charged with protecting and patrolling Yosemite and Sequoia National Park. And many of the campsites and trails that they established then are still in use today. You know, we can also take a look at Stephen Bishop, who before the Civil War was leading trips as a guide through Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. There's also a gentleman by the name of Lancelot Jones, who was a fishing guide in Biscayne Bay, who donated the land and created the advocacy for the creation of Biscayne National Park in Florida. You know, so the history of people of color's participation in the outdoors, especially when it comes to national parks, goes literally all the way back to the beginning. It's the telling of that history that I think is really important that we need to do more of today so that we inspire and encourage more people of color to be part of the national park experience. You know, what Wallace Stegner described as America's best idea.
We talked a little bit about this earlier, but I'm just curious about how, you know, to me, geography has a lot to do with it, too, and just the ability to get to some of these parks. My family didn't own a car when I was growing up, so anywhere we went had to be accessible by public transportation, and that often didn't include a lot of the national parks that we had access to, and there are many reasons for that historically in New York, the way New York was designed. But I'm wondering how that, Nicole, has had, what effect that's had on children of color, in particular families of color who live in cities.
Yes, that was definitely an issue for me. I actually don't own a vehicle. I actually don't have a driver's license. So I, to this day, still use public transportation. And growing up, my first visit to Cuyahoga Valley National Park was in sixth grade, through a field trip. And I didn't know at the time that we were actually going to a national park in Ohio. I thought it was just another faraway place that had a lot of, you know, trees and trails. And I didn't necessarily feel connected to the space. But then as I got older, I realized it was connected to our metro park system, which is more accessible through public transportation. And the more information I found out in terms of what parks I can go to that were closer to where I lived, the more I understood that there is some connection to being able to go on my own by car with other family members, but still connecting to that space and not necessarily having to, like, for example, I felt like I had to go with white friends to those types of places to enjoy them. And if that didn't happen, it would be years before, you know, we had another family reunion or we went to a park similar to that and felt like, okay, this is something we can do as a family on our own.
James, in 2017, President Obama issued a memorandum called Promoting Diversity and Inclusion in Our National Parks, National Forests, and Other Public Lands and Waters. Did it actually do what it was intended to do?
Well, as most presidential memorandums go, you know, they basically are provisions or suggestions on how government agencies should perform. And if you go to you know, many of the park managers and park supervisors, they will tell you that they are diligently working to create diversity, equity, inclusion programs of some kind. But without the reinforcing narrative that comes from the Department of the Interior, right down from the president, to say, these are the things that I would like to see as part of my administration to have better representation, both in terms of employment, in terms of management, in terms of visitation. You know, the agencies are really only as capable of honoring this this presidential memorandum as they have the power to enforce it. Now, it's safe to say that things indeed are happening, but frankly, there just hasn't been enough happening in the last 4 years. I mean, there have been you know, many great opportunities to try to expand the participation of more types of people in public land management, and it's not happening to the degree that I personally would like to see it, but I definitely think that it's an ongoing process, and there just needs to be more activation and activists that will go on to make sure that we create opportunities for more people of color in particular to experience the outdoors in a positive way.
Nicole, are there specific initiatives that the National Park Services is doing to increase inclusivity and diversity at its parks?
Yeah, so I definitely remember specifically the Every Kid in a Park initiative, and that was something that really stood out to me because it was allotted to every fourth grader to get a free pass visit to a national park with their family, which I thought was great. But I think there's still some kind of gaps that need to be filled in terms of how that's continuing to be promoted. And do people feel like they have easy access to those initiatives? And if not, what can still be improved? And in terms of the Great American Outdoors Act or bill being passed, I think there's definitely more opportunities to step it up and really show communities of color that they can be a part of the stories and the narratives as we continue forward in preserving our national parks and also being, you know, continuing to be advocates and help people really see the beauty, but also the community involved in bringing those pieces together is definitely needed.
And James, what about you? What do you think could be done to further this idea of more diverse park attendance?
A lot of what can be done is being done by the general public. I mean, one of the great revelations of the last decade has been the increased appearance of people of color in social media. You know, we're seeing fabulous pictures of African Americans, Native Americans, Hispanics, Asian people, you know, taking their pictures in parks and literally creating agency to encourage their family members, their peers, to go out and have these positive experiences. You know, and one of the things I think that many people are realizing is once they get there, that there are things that they can do to help improve those areas, whether it is exercising principles of leave no trace, to pick up trash, to do a better job of educating young people in particular to recognize the importance and value of public land, but also perhaps more than anything else, you know, making sure that these lands are protected for future generations so that, you know, 20, 30, 50, 60 years from now, there will indeed be a generation of stewards who will carry on the legacy of public land management.
James Edward Mills is a freelance journalist and the author of The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. And Nicole Jackson is an environmental educator and Next Generation Advisory Council member at the National Parks Conservation Association. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.